All right, I call this meeting of Senate Resources Committee to order. For those online, if you could mute yourselves till we get to you, I'd appreciate it. Let the record reflect that it is 3:28 p.m. on Monday, March 22nd, 2021. And present today are a quorum. We have Senator Bishop, Senator Stevens, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Kawasaki, Senator Keel, Senator Machicki, and myself, Senator Reback. Staffing the committee today is our committee aide, Betty Tangeman, LIO moderator, Nate Williams, and we have Christopher Dickrell online from Records. Thank you to you all. Just a reminder, please make sure your cell phones are off. And for those of you joining us via Teams, please have your mic on mute and your video off until being called on to speak. This will help so that our bandwidth can handle all the information flowing. If you somehow get disconnected, please rejoin via Teams, the Teams link, or call the conference line. Today's agenda consists of two presentations from some very well-known folks. First, we have the Honorable and former Lieutenant Governor Meade Treadwell, who is presently the Chairman and CEO of Keelac LNG. His Chief Operating Officer David Clark is also joining us. The second presentation will be for Mr. Frank Richards, President of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, also known as AGDC. After these presentations, we'll hear some remarks from Lorelei Simon, Vice President of External Affairs for Usabelli Coal, regarding the unique value that the coal industry brings to the interior of Alaska. Given our limited time today, I'd appreciate if members would please hold your questions until the end of each presentation. Obviously, if you have a burning desire, we will try to accommodate. Let's go ahead and get started with Keelac LNG. Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Meade Treadwell. I'm Chairman and CEO of Keelac LNG. I reside at 528 N Street in Anchorage, and the address of our company is on the prepared testimony we've given you. With me today is David Clark, who is our President and Chief Operating Officer. And we have given you a set of written testimony and some slides. And Mr. Chairman, with your indulgence, what I'd like to do is go to the slides, if we could, just to begin with fairly quickly and skip to the next slide that you have there.
Yes, please do.
Yeah, by way of, and I think Betty was going to advance slides for us, but I'm not sure how that's happening there. But let me just say, I've struggled, as many of you in this room have, with the challenge of marketing North Slope gas and commercializing our gas ever since I came to Alaska. I worked on issues related to the pipeline across Canada, to the Yukon Pacific pipeline. I was treasurer of that company that Governor Hickel and Governor Hagan formed with Robert O. Anderson. I as lieutenant governor, I helped steer us back toward the Asian markets when the legislature created AGDC. Very happy that we're in the Asian markets right now. And while we were doing all of this, and you'll hear from Frank about the substantial work that they've been doing, something revolutionary was happening in Russia. And let me just go to this slide here and remind us of a few things. We have 32.4 TCF of proven gas reserves owned by ExxonMobil, Hillcorp, and ConocoPhillips on the Alaska North Slope, and probable gas reserves of 100 TCF. We have a lot of gas. Previous efforts to commercialize this gas have been too expensive and uncompetitive so far. I mean, what happened with us at Yukon Pacific, the first attempt to market the LNG from the North Slope out of the South Coast, was we couldn't pay enough for the gas to make up for the lost oil. And I'm not speaking for Yukon Pacific at this time. I'm just saying that that's my calculus of why that project didn't go forward. We had several projects trying to take gas down the Alaska Highway, and the cost of getting it to the hub in Calgary was more expensive than the value of the gas at that hub. In the meantime, as we've been working on the latest project across Alaska, something revolutionary has happened in the Arctic. Yamal LNG has proven the economic viability of Arctic LNG using ice-breaking LNG tankers to export LNG throughout the year. And what's very interesting about geography is this, is from Yamal to get to the ice edge in the Bering Strait is 2,600 miles. For us to get to the ice age in the Bering Strait from a place like Point Thompson is much, much closer, 2,000 miles closer. So we see the concept of actually building on the North Slope. Let's go to the next phase and next slide again. What you saw there, Yamal's first exports are about 16.8 million tons per year. That's the same size plant. Excuse me for a second. That's the same size plant and production as we were talking about for more than the Yukon Pacific pipeline, a little bit less than the AGDC pipeline. They too have decided to go to floating nearshore LNG facilities for their next move. And if you take a look at proposed LNG projects in the Russian Arctic, they've got one now, which is 16.5 million tons. They expect to do 20 million tons with Arctic LNG 2, where they've already reached FID decision. We will be seeing coming through the Bering Strait 4 to 5 cargoes a day, 1,500 to 1,800 tanker shipments a year going between Alaska and Russia to the Asian market. And so for us to do this from the North Slope, we took a look at the possible gas fields, talked with the producers, and we entered a heads of agreement with ExxonMobil as the operator of Point Thompson. And the concept, very simply, is to condition the gas onshore, to build a subsea pipeline of 6 to 9 miles into federal waters offshore, to build a nearshore LNG plant that would be on a gravity-based structure that would be grounded in about 45 feet of water, deep enough water to have a proper turning radius for the tankers, and far enough out to help avoid conflicts with subsistence whaling, as food security is a core value of our company. Let's go to the next slide. The shipping from Point Thompson would be via the same kind of tankers, and if we can go to the next slide, Betty, from that, which would be ice-class LNG carriers. There have been 15 of these vessels now manufactured, all in a Korean shipyard. As you can see, they have a spoon-shaped bow that operates in ice, a V-shaped bow that operates in open water. They are much, much more efficient than what we call your grandfather's icebreakers. And there's a Mark II design that is out that is actually a reduction in cost and more powerful and more efficient, which is what we concluded in our pre-feasibility study and some of our additional work would be needed. They're about $290 million apiece. The next slide, if you take a look at Asian markets, what's very interesting about the geography here is that if you ship from the North Slope or if you ship from Cook Inlet, the distance to Tokyo is only about 40 miles difference. So every attempt we've had to build a multi-billion dollar pipeline to come across Alaska doesn't get us much closer to the market. I will say, since we announced this project in late 2019, we had identified at the time some offtake in China that Lloyd's Energy, our parent company, has been working on, and Ron Chen identified some offtake in the Philippines. Since that time, we've signed preliminary agreements with two large Japanese trading companies for offtake, as well as one transshipment operation, to the point, Mr. Chairman, where I believe we have more than double the capacity that we need for this project offtake as we are able to mature that in the next phase of engineering and feasibility. Let me, Betty, if you want to skip the next slide, the next two slides, let me just turn to one other issue which has come up certainly with the current administration. If you want to go further down, yeah, that slide. LNG is a very, very important fuel for helping to clean up energy around the world. Our new Secretary of Energy said that she supports LNG exports for that reason, and that she's also hopeful that the LNG industry can reduce its own emissions. I think in Alaska, we start with a very good start. We're starting with conventional gas. We would sequester our CO2 in the field, so it'd be reinjected back into the field. We would be operating in very cold temperatures where the efficiency per amount of gas used to do the liquefaction is quite significant. We would be using new technology with less volatile, with the refrigerant component would not be an emitter. Our distance to Japan, to Northeast Asia, is the closest of any U.S. markets, any U.S. supply, and so we have savings there. And, Mr. Chairman, in our most recent discussions with senior members of the Japanese government, others, there is a great interest in forming our feasibility studies to also do a screening on reduction of greenhouse gas emissions further, including the possibility of bringing carbon dioxide back to Alaska for reinjection in fields that could use it for enhanced oil production, such as Cook Inlet. So with that, I just want Alaskans to know that we're very much aware and awake to the issues. We believe that we're part of the solution. We believe that we are America's best choice in LNG, as you can see on this slide. And we believe that Alaska has much to benefit from pursuing this project. The last thing I'd like to say is that on page, the last part of my testimony is, what can this legislature do to progress that long-held goal? We urge you to support this option and companies like ours that want to invest private funds in Alaska to pioneer a breakthrough for Alaska gas development. We encourage you to ask the Alaska Energy Authority to update its past work on LNG deliveries to coastal communities, given the potential of our supply, the existing potential of Russian and Canadian containerized LNG supply, and advances in ISO containers that make LNG supply to small communities more viable, even if those communities are not accessible by sea or river ice during portions of the year. State and federal government's support for this project is essential, as is support of the North Slope Borough. At an appropriate time, we will be before the state for approval of royalty gas sales associated with our project. I would say that's in the next phase. Maintaining a stable tax structure is necessary to securing the financing that is required to develop this project, and we may have some fiscal issues that would affect our economics, which we'd be back in touch with. We've been in touch with AIDA, the Alaska Industrial Development Export Authority. We believe they have most of the legal authority they have to support a viable infrastructure project. And while we're not looking for state support, and this project has many financing options, we do look to have some ownership of the project held by Alaskans, and I believe AIDA can help do that. Governor Dunleavy has asked this legislature for support of his efforts to defend equities Alaska gained at statehood. The state has the right and authority to develop its resources and to transit federal land to do it, and we will need to transit federal land to place this gravity-based structure in the right area. Lieutenant Governor Meyer and I have been working with the State Committee on Research at the University, and we are very interested in seeing support on screening technologies to be used in Alaska for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, helping our nation and other nations meet net zero greenhouse gas emissions. And finally, our Department of Natural Resources has an agreement in place with Japan's Bank for International Cooperation. We've had many constructive talks with JBIC, and I appreciate the personal ties our governor and our U.S. senators have forged from that agreement, and we hope it's renewed at the appropriate time. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'm very happy to answer questions, as is Mr. Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Treadwell. Do we have questions from members of the committee?
Yes.
Yes, Senator Von Imhoff.
So just to confirm here, thank you, Mr. Treadwell. That was wonderful. Actually, this, if we can commercialize the Alaska gas, I think that would be a good thing for our state. It says right here in your document, our initial pre-feasibility level cost estimate for the project was approximately $5 billion. And does that include then a gas conditioning plant, the 6-mile pipeline offshore, and the equipment needed to do that?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff, the $5 billion includes the pipeline and the offshore gasification or liquefaction plant, the storage and loading. It does not include the conditioning plant. Our heads of agreement, which we entered into, looks at the Point Thompson unit is actually providing that conditioning. I will say that as the feasibility study configuration that we're working on prior to FEED has come up, we're also looking at the possibility of including the conditioning offshore or looking at perhaps a different configuration onshore. But the $5 billion is essentially for 4 million tons a year of production, or about $1,250 per ton.
Can I continue?
Yes, please, Senator Lonenhoff.
Do you know, we're hearing financing options, at least for oil drilling, offshore oil drilling, sort of drying up. What are you finding about financing options for gas, offshore gas?
So, through the chair, Senator Rundhimoff, you and I have both been aware of redlining efforts, or sometimes called ice lining efforts, by certain global banks against Arctic production. I guess I would make the point, and I believe we made the point, Alaska's delegation has made the point, that you should look at every project on its own merits. And on its own merits, this is producing conventional gas. On its own merits, this is requiring a very small incremental amount of infrastructure. It's very different. And I'll just say that in our global financing efforts, we had a couple of banks maybe step away from the table, but we have not found an appreciable problem on this issue, on the ice lining issue to date.
Okay. Just the very last question. Thank you, Mr. Chubb. The last question is there any way to kind of get a sense of what the investment was in Yamal and how, to the degree possible, I don't even know if it's possible, to kind of figure out how they're doing, like what's the return on their investment, and is it something that is it comparable to what we're planning to do here? Are they getting a return? Can you tell to the extent that you can?
Well, and I'd like to jump in here real quick, because that's along the lines of the question that I was going to ask. So maybe if you could go into a little bit about how long you mentioned that this has been proven, the Russians are doing it. So if you could just give us a little bit more information on how long they've been doing it, and maybe start there while you're answering your question, I'd really appreciate that.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, and I'm also going to invite David to help answer that question if he would like to. When I was Lieutenant Governor, I was chair for Alaska, the Arctic Winter Games, and I saw my counterpart, the Governor and the Vice Governor of Yamal, many times in the early 2010s. I remember saying to them as they reached FID on this that I hope they waved at us as they went by in the Bering Straits, but if they thumbed their nose because they beat us to the market, I didn't blame them. We've watched that project very, very closely. The fact that they did start with quite a bit of kind of incentive work with the icebreakers on shore, but then it turns out that they probably did not need the subsidy for the icebreakers for their second round. Also, if you take a look at how much they are planning to produce, which is somewhere around 110 to 130 million tons a year, that's the equivalent of 5 or 6 of the AGDC pipelines. That's the equivalent of 25 of our projects. The Russian government is not big enough to subsidize that business. They are going for a very large amount of market share, and we can beat them on transportation economics. We can beat them on distance. We can beat them on greenhouse gas emissions. And very honestly, in terms of the security of the Northeast Pacific, we can beat them on security and diversity. To Senator Von Himhoff's question about specific economics, let me see what we can get. And David, if you have anything to add on that, I'd be very happy to have you speak.
Through the chair. Yeah, so Novatek are looking to increase their first project from 20 million tons. They're looking to expand their LNG production from 60 to 80 million tons a year. The economics are a little bit hard to detect on the first project because the Russian government did subsidize the port development. But they, like us, have got relatively cheap gas and access to a lot of markets in Asia.
Continue, please. Continue if you had more.
Well, one other thing is when the LNG price spiked last January to above $30 per million we can use. And a lot of the LNG producers in the Gulf Coast were unable to transit through the Panama Canal, which is heavily bottlenecked. And they had to take the long route around the Cape, which actually triples the distance compared to the distance from Alaska. So we see a lot of competitive advantages for this project.
Thank you very much. We have a question from Senator Michiki.
Yeah, thank you, Mead. I guess we can compare it to the creative Russian economics of Yamal, but in a more traditional sense with tidewater production, I see your reduction from 1,900 per ton to 1,250 in comparison to AK LNG, but what about the more traditional tidewater producers? How do we compete with APLNG and Qatar Gas, who just increased their production by 30% with a very minor, relatively minor investment? How do we compete with those traditional markets where transportation is difficult to make up the difference? Even though you have the distance, you have significantly lower cost production.
Well, I think the way through the chair to the Senate President, the main thing that we've got on our side is we've got a better climate story, we've got a better transportation cost story, we have a we do not have competing gas prices at the wellhead with, say, the Henry Hub, where you can see a lot of volatility in that area. We do not have the Panama Canal. And we have a cost of overall production, which I believe is competitive with other supplies, including some of the supplies that you've talked about in the Gulf. Qatar is making a big effort to expand its market share. Russia is obviously making a big effort to expand its market share. This past week, the United States broke its own LNG export records, and I think it's important that, you know, we used to be the plant that you used to operate. You used to be the only LNG exporter from the United States, and now we export quite a bit. I think we're going to be approaching 8 or 9 billion cubic feet a day, so it's quite a bit. But I believe that we are competitive in that marketplace, and the buyers we talked to believe that as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff has a question.
Thank you. So if the state of Alaska does not invest in this, the state still makes money, though, in its royalty in kind or royalty returns. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So if there's a group of – thank you. Follow up?
Yes, please.
So if there's a group of investors that deems Alaska's gas as viable and competitive and they want to invest – what do you really need from the state at this point to make this go forward?
Well, Senator Van Hemel, through the chair, first off, just thank you for your question and thank you for holding this hearing. We announced this in late 2019, and as you know, during the 2020 session, there was very little focus except on COVID and the budget and so forth. We wanted to bring you up to date on our efforts, up to date on what our competitors are doing. I didn't mention that Canada is also doing a study on doing this right out of the McKinsey area. I will say this is a pioneering project for North America. We have slightly different ice conditions, even though it's 2,000 miles less ice. It is not that state attention is not important. I believe it's going to be important in our royalty discussions, as I mentioned. I believe the availability of EIA financing can be helpful to help Alaskans own a piece of the project as we go for global financing. I think the answer is give this your moral support and a try, and we may be back on fiscals, but we wanted you to be aware of what we're doing.
Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Bishop.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, good afternoon. If and when you do come back on the fiscals, could you I don't know if you're prepared to say anything now, but when you do come back, maybe be prepared to tell the committee how you're going to engage with Alaska contractors and Alaska labor to build this project.
Through the chair, Senator Bishop, absolutely. We'd be very happy to do that. I will just tell you that we are focused right now on trying to come up with a competitive way for the first time, because we've been trying. I first got involved in the natural gas issue in the late 70s, and I know you've been involved in it a long time yourself. If we can find a pioneering way like the Russians have to do direct export, the number of jobs that are likely to the state, the royalty income likely to the state, it may not be as many construction jobs as a pipeline, but it will be Alaskans who will be operating this project. We are in negotiation with a shipping company right now where we've made it very clear we want to give them an opportunity to work with Alaskans as joint venture partners. We know it's very important for residents of the North Slope Borough to be involved. The conditioning plan, I'm sure, will likely have an ad valorem tax component. The pipeline will have an ad valorem tax component. We're very, very interested in making sure that Alaskans benefit. My request to you today that you encourage the Alaska Energy Authority to redo its studies on local gas distribution with LNG and ISO containers would actually help make the case, and we will do everything we can to make gas available for distribution in Alaska. So I'd be very happy to talk to you about that in greater depth.
Thank you. We have one last question from Senator Machiki.
Yeah, Mead, just I'm looking forward to the fiscal comparison as well with the two markets that I talked about, the Tidewater producers. But you and I have both been to countries where there's coastal distribution, which is obviously a key concern here. You talked about it a little bit on ISOs, but as far as economically distributing, like what occurs in Japan and Norway, is that a part of what you're considering for your project at all on smaller coastal tankers, or are you primarily running your economics on kind of mainline offtake?
Through the chair, Mr. President, you know, had this been a normal year, I probably would have dragged you with us to Japan. And I know you're very familiar with those markets. We're talking with one particular entity that actually, we've been talking with three particular entities in Japan that are following a national plan to try to be a transshipper of energy to other ports in Eastern Asia. So the answer is some of our gas may end up going to places as far as Vietnam. I'd like to thank the governor and his economic development team for helping us with some of those discussions there. But it would probably be transshipped through Japan. There's smaller ports up and down the Yangtze River that need smaller tankers, and that quite possibly could come through transshipping in Japan. The Russians are looking transshipping out of Kamchatka. We're not necessarily looking at depending on Kamchatka, but the heavier icebreakers that we talked about, we think the closest port we would go to is Japan, Northern Korea, China, and transship perhaps the smaller or more conventional tankers for markets beyond.
Thank you.
Well, thank you, Lieutenant Governor Treadwell, for joining us and bringing us up to speed on what KELAC is doing. We appreciate your willingness to be here and testify in front of the committee. Next, we have AGDC, Mr. Richards. Mr. Richards, if you could please put yourself on the record and proceed with your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Frank Richards. I am the president of the Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. Betty, please, if you could advance to slide 2. Very quickly, Mr. Chairman, for the public, I just wanted to identify who AGDC is. We are the state's Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation. We were created by the Alaska State Legislature with the goal of providing maximum benefit of Alaska's North Slope natural gas resources through development of infrastructure necessary to move that natural gas to markets within the state of Alaska as well as into international markets. Next slide, please. So briefly, a history of AGDC. We were originally envisioned in 2010 when there was issues around the potential steep decline in Cook Inlet for South Central Alaska. And the Alaska legislature created under House Bill 369 an opportunity to look for feasibility to bring North Slope gas to South Central. We were created in House Bill 4 and empowered to provide for the development of that in-state project. And then in 2014, asked to represent the state of Alaska in the Alaska LNG project, which was then being led by ExxonMobil. In 2016, at the time, TransCanada was also representing the state in the pipeline, and the state elected to purchase TransCanada's responsibilities and provide that to AGDC. And then later in 2016, there was work efforts where the cost of oil, the downturn in the economy, the producers wanted to slow down the project and offered up to then Governor Walker to take on the responsibility of the Alaska LNG project, which in 2017, we were handed that responsibility in total to be able to move the Alaska LNG project forward, primarily through the regulatory process, which we did, and we're actually awarded then our authorization to construct by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission in 2020, along with completion of an environmental impact statement authorizing us to proceed forward. Next slide, please. Our board of directors had asked us early in 2020 to look at our strategic plan and develop how we would best proceed. Looking backwards at 2016, we had a project that was severely challenged in regards to the economics due to the high cost of the project, and we were charged with bringing that project forward. So we developed a strategic plan to be able to look at the competitiveness of the project for ways to reduce the overall cost and the cost of supply, and then also to look for continued private sector investment and involvement in the project to be able to move this forward and back to truly a private sector-led development. So it was that 2016 work effort that was done originally by Wood Mackenzie that identified this project as truly uneconomic at the time due to the cost, and so we've had to find ways to be able to move that forward. In 2018 also, with the election of Governor Dunleavy, he made it a clear direction to the corporation that we also should be looking to bring the private sector back into the project development and ultimately oversight of that. Moving on to slide number 5, the proposed structure of the alignment that we have now is certainly different than the equity model that was originally envisioned with the producers, and certainly different than the debt for equity model that was proposed by former Governor Walker. This new venture structure is based more on a tolling model. The proposed commercial structure is non-integrated, meaning different investors can focus their investment in specific components of the project. This will allow the gas treatment plant and the pipeline to be structured as tolling facilities in line with guidance that was originally developed by Wood Mackenzie in 2016. And then companies with specific technical capabilities can now be attracted to the project without exposure to risk of other project components. Pipeline companies can focus on the pipeline, while LNG companies can focus on the LNG plant, similar to Gulf of Mexico LNG project. This model is very similar to that being pursued by LNG Canada, which also has a pipeline with separate investors than the LNG plant. Slide number 6, please, Betty. So for AGDC, what we've been working on with a group of parties that we call the strategic parties is to be able to advance the structure and leadership of the project, working with this group that includes North Slope producers, a major North American pipeline developer, LNG buyers, and then banks and financial corporations. These bodies collectively have a total market capitalization of about $1.25 trillion. They have the technical and financial capability to execute a project of this size and complexity. And they're also helping us to be able to entice potentially new strategic parties that have significant market capitalization to also come and work to collectively with this group to be able to move this project forward. Next slide, please. So the work efforts that we have been doing then over the last couple of years included looking at the overall cost of the project and came up with a strategy and optimizations to be able to reduce the cost of that project by nearly $8.5 billion to a current total install cost of about $38.7 billion. That level of cost reduction allowed us to pass through our economic stage gate for advancing this project to the next major gate, which would be entry into FEED. Along with that, we have also received major federal approvals from the Department of Energy. We also received authorization to ship to non-free trade countries. That, along with the existing authorization for free trade, now means that there's no limitations on the sale of this LNG in the Asian markets. Along with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission authorization to construct, the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission also provided offtake approval for up to 3.6 billion cubic feet a day from the North Slope, without then with consideration then on that it would not severely impact the oil production. And then we're also continuing with engagement and support from not only the state government but also the federal government in continuing to help to advance this project and ways to make it more economic, more viable going into the future. So next slide, please. As I said, we're working with upstream owners. We have very good support from those parties, again, from both Point Thompson unit operators as well as the Prudhoe Bay operators. We've reached indicative terms for the gas supply and agreed upon those, and then also having consideration for those parties to participate in the gas treatment plant as not only owners but operators. On the pipeline, we're working now with a leading North American pipeline company, and we have strong interest from infrastructure banks to be able to help promote this tolling arrangement. And then in terms of offtakes, we too are working with those Asian markets and have had continuing discussions with those Asian markets about the offtake from Alaska. And I will say, again, what Mead presented to you and the project that I'm talking about right now are complementary because of the tremendous resources that we have on the North Slope. And then lastly, we're working, again, to find and have participating a true project lead for the liquefaction facility, someone that has that operating capability and execution strategy to be able to develop and proceed forward with that project. And we are working and have talked to now some of the major LNG operators around the world to gain interest. So next slide, please. So a quick review for the public. The Alaska LNG project, again, is utilizing the natural gas resources from Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay, approximately 34 TCF or trillion cubic feet of discovered produced conventional resource. What I mean by that, it is developed on a daily basis. It comes up with the oil or the condensate in Point Thompson and then is reinjected back into the field for reservoir pressure regulation. This would allow us to utilize those resources and bring it to market. We would have to condition the gas, and that would be done in Prudhoe Bay, where the combined gas stream from Point Thompson and Prudhoe Bay would be combined. The CO2 would be extracted and then reinjected back into the reservoir. So truly sequestration of the carbon dioxide and not released to the atmosphere. It would then flow into an 807-mile pipeline carrying about 3.3 billion cubic feet a day down to Tidewater, to Nikiski, where, again, the Phillips plant was operating for 50-plus years under the tutelage of the Senate president and showed that Alaska could provide LNG to the world markets, or particularly Japan, uninterrupted for many, many decades. There we would construct a 20 million ton per year liquefaction facility and a loading berth to allow for two cargo ships to be able to offtake that product daily and ship it to the Asian markets. This project is one that, as Mead talked about earlier, is in consideration for what is known as low carbon LNG, because we're looking to utilize power generated from hydroelectric facilities. So there's a new term called low carbon LNG, where if you're utilizing renewable resources to generate electricity, then you can add that moniker to that. And that's where we're looking to use Bradley Lake hydroelectric electricity to be able to help power that plant. Next slide, please. The work that we've done over the last couple of years in terms of working with the federal agencies, including the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, has come to a conclusion in 2020. We were fortunate enough to be designated a FAST 41 project, meaning we had a designation where federal agencies had to develop schedules and be able to meet those schedules or have to report back to Congress on why they were slipping their schedules. I will say in 2020, we received all of our federal permits. That includes the EIS, that includes the FERC order, the 404 permit, the EPA 401 certification, our incidental take regulations, and our incidental harassment authorization for protected marine species. So all of these federal permits necessary to construct AGDC now has in hand. And today I was just informed we were provided the state right-of-way grant, which means that in addition to the federal right-of-way grants that we already had, we now have about 90% of the right-of-way for the gas conditioning facility and the pipeline in hand and able to move it forward. And then lastly, again, we were able to work on reducing the cost of this project and lowering it by $8.5 billion. Next slide, please. That cost reduction work was done in conjunction with folks from BP and ExxonMobil. They were kind enough to allow us to utilize their updated resources and knowledge and expertise to be able to validate optimizations, to be able to look at the overall project and come up with ways to reduce that. We worked with an independent third party, Fluor Corporation, to be able to develop those cost opportunities and update the cost estimate utilizing their information that they have not only from the producers, BP and ExxonMobil, but their own internal cost metrics because they're currently working on LNG projects in other parts of the world. That's where we feel that the cost validation, the reduction of $8.5 billion was validated by the work efforts. And we feel that that new number of about $38.7 billion is truly representative of what we could bring this project in for. Next slide, please. This chart shows where we were on the left-hand side in 2016. The Alaska LNG project was nearly at a cost about $12 per million BTUs delivered to Asia. And since then, with the cost reductions and the optimizations that I've talked about previously, we now are at a range of about $7.40. So we've moved from the highest cost project now to what we feel is more in the middle of the pack with our competition. And as you can see on the far right-hand side, the Qatar expansion is really the low-cost project out there, and it's one that's hard to beat with the tremendous resources. But we feel that the efforts that we've undertaken to be able to reduce the cost is, again, indicative of the opportunity for Alaska and for private sector developers to market this project and to be able to move it forward. And we've taken into consideration the efforts that were addressed by Wood Mackenzie to the producers and to the state legislature in 2016 on ways to be able to optimize this project. Next slide, please. So we feel that the Alaska LNG project, again, in the middle of the pack, right now we feel that there are ways to be able to continue to optimize that project and make it even more economic. And that's where this waterfall chart identifies there are certain things such as the cost of the gas at the wellhead, federal loan guarantees, the issue around payment in lieu of taxes, and other cost optimizations in regards to plant development on operations. In order to achieve this, again, two of the main factors that will take both the administration and the work of the legislature is to discuss and around the payment in lieu of taxes and fiscal stability. Next slide, please. As you heard from Mead, one of the major issues that the state has is, again, making sure that we have a stable fiscal regime so that any potential investment coming in knows that the tax structure that they're going to be looking at isn't going to change. We have successfully had a stable tax regime over the last couple of years, even though there have been some public initiatives to try and raise the taxes. But that makes it Alaska more of a potential risk than a more stable tax regime would be, as other regimes around the world are providing in regards to LNG projects. So they're getting concessions being granted to them by their host governments on fiscal stabilization causes. The other main factor, as I talked about, is the PILT or the property tax issue. Alaska is essentially an order of magnitude higher than any jurisdictions, whether it be in the lower 48 or in other countries around the world, for property taxes and payment in lieu of taxes. We're at a rate of about 15 times what jurisdictions in Louisiana and Texas are paying in terms of property taxes for their plants. So that's an opportunity then for Alaska to be able to make ourselves more competitive by identifying opportunities or significant other ways to be able to lower those property taxes, but also provide potential ownership opportunities to those boroughs in lieu of the tax rates. And then also going forward, since AGDC is currently 100% owner of the Alaska LNG project, the state needs to decide on what level of participation as we bring in private sector investment. Should we dilute our ownership from 100% to zero, or should we have retained a small percentage of ownership, and what percentage ownership should that be? So those are, again, conversations that we would like to engage with the legislature and administration on to be able to identify how we can best move the project forward. Quickly, on the next slide, I wanted to just talk about or represent what happened during the COVID to LNG prices. As David and Reid talked about, there was a significant reduction in prices at the beginning of the pandemic into the spot market ranges of between $2 and $3. And then as winter hit in Asia, you saw this massive spike in price, about going up almost 15 times to just about $35 million per BTU. And then it has settled down again back into that $5 to $6 range. So again, these are spot prices, but I just wanted to give a look back to how that impacted the world market. Those that had markets to sell in the January timeframe made a significant amount of money. On the next slide, I wanted to look forward then in terms of where the markets may go to in this new world where folks are putting out decarbonization goals. And we've heard from many Asian countries and European countries on the goal of going carbon neutral by 2050, 2060 timeframe. So what is that going to mean for the LNG market? We had Gas Strategies produce this chart that shows from now through the 2030, 2040 timeframe, we will likely see a doubling of the LNG market. And that's in line with what you saw from Mead. But we wanted to see what's the impact then of that market should there be decarbonization initiatives put in place. So the orange line really shows a partial transition, meaning a slight delay in the decarbonization efforts. And then the next red line or purple line shows a delay of about 10 years from the shift from coal to LNG or ultimately to hydrogen. But what we see in this chart on the blue line is, again, a potential peak of LNG at about 800 to 900 million tons per year, and then potentially a reduction. And this reduction would be taken by the creation of a hydrogen fuel and hydrogen delivery mechanism to be able to meet the demand. So that's the first time that we've seen potentially for that Alaska's natural gas, if not brought to market, may not be brought to market if we expand out into the 2050, 2060 timeframe. So next slide, please. Now that we all heard as the Biden administration came in, a lot of executive orders addressing oil and gas and trying to limit that. We heard about the decarbonization realities that they would like to push forward. But we're also seeing that there are truly some folks within the administration that are recognizing that we're not going to turn on a dime and turn off coal and natural gas and shift directly to renewables. But it's going to take a conversion. And it's going to take a considerable amount of time to be able to do that. Likely by the 2050 timeframe, you'd still have coal and natural gas contributing to electrical production in the United States. The wind and solar, again, will increase, but it's not going to necessarily meet the overall demand within our country. And that there are countries out there in Asia, specifically in China, which does have the world's highest carbon dioxide emissions, that it's going to take some time to be able to shift that economy and that power generation to something that is less polluting. and that's where LNG will continue to play a role as a bridge fuel moving into the next few decades. So next slide, please. So from our perspective, the Alaska LNG project does have significant positive impacts for Alaska for decades to come. The project could underpin gas and oil industry in Alaska to provide an outlet for associated gas with potential oil finds that will hopefully develop on the North Slope. And that would reduce the overall risk of those exploration and operations to have an outlet for that associated gas. We know that there's tremendous resources up there that Alaska could then monetize to be able to help with our treasury. And then we see that these projects, again, not only the construction, but long-term operation will generate high-paying private sector jobs, you know, for a long time into the future. And then from our perspective, we can provide that gas to Alaskans along the pipeline route and ultimately potentially down the river systems and or through ISO containers for shipment off of the road system and river systems to isolated villages and bring them cleaner burning energy for the future. And then ultimately, as we look to the future and potential, there's an opportunity for blue hydrogen production with the natural gas molecules that we have, and certainly the basin in Cook Inlet is a potential carbon sequestration sink that would fit right hand in hand with production of the blue hydrogen. Next slide, please. As 2020 came around and we saw the impacts of the COVID pandemic within Alaska with the loss of the cruise ship industry and the hits to oil and gas and many and associated industries in Alaska, we saw that we were hit severely. We had tremendous job losses of over 27,000 in the labor market. Never in state history have we lost that many jobs. We're back to job levels at about 2003 level, and it's going to take some time to be able to bring us back. So in that vein, we started talking with the governor about the opportunity then, and on the next slide, of utilizing the authorizations that the Alaska Gasline Development Corporation has received and potentially phasing the Alaska LNG project to be able to meet the concerns about providing lower cost energy to interior Alaska, to be able to address the issues around the air quality issues in interior Alaska, but then also to provide a job opportunity by developing this first phase of the project, which would be the gas line from Point Thompson to Fairbanks as an infrastructure project. And I have to emphasize that this is not asking for state of Alaska monies. This is recognizing that money may be flowing out of Washington, D.C. for infrastructure development, and this may be a critical piece of infrastructure for Alaska to be able to move forward with. So next slide, please. So this project would have potentially very near-term positive impacts, where we would have a project that would be 4 years to execute. It'd be about $5.9 billion. We're identifying this as potentially clean energy infrastructure because, again, it would provide lower carbon burning natural gas to interior Alaska to replace some of the wood and diesel generation that's currently underway right there. We feel we're unique because we have permits and major authorizations in place to be able to begin phase one work right now. And it really relies on, again, the largesse of the federal government and infrastructure program. So moving on to the next slide, this really identifies that it is a pipeline project. So utilizing Point Thompson gas initially, because it doesn't require as much conditioning and removal of CO2, to flow that into the 32-inch above-ground Point Thompson transmission line to a flange location at the future gas treatment plant, and then the 42-inch main line down to Fairbanks. So that concept, again, is $5.9 billion. We feel like it could proceed rapidly because we have the designs in place and the authorizations to be able to move forward. And it would significantly reduce the risk overall of the second phase, which would be the full-scale Alaska LNG project. And again, we'd be working with private sector to develop this effort and be able to move this project through to execution and delivery. Next slide, please. One of the things that the Alaska legislature gave us under Senate Bill 138 in 2014 was a directive to utilize Alaskan labor, Alaska residents, Alaska businesses, and Alaskan expertise. And that's where we would be using that bountiful entity within the state of Alaska to be able to move this project forward. And we have been working with the Department of Labor. We've been working to identify what the job skills and job requirements would be if we were able to proceed forward with this first phase of the Alaska LNG project. So next slide, please. And in the near term, the first 24 months, we would see an infusion into the labor market of about $1.5 billion, which results in about 1,400 direct high-paying construction jobs, with a multiplier then of about up to 20,000 indirect jobs. And this would then benefit those hard-hit industries, whether it be in the restaurant or hotels, but including transportation and warehousing and construction industries that we could help then move project people back into the workforce and being productive in producing something that would be a piece of critical infrastructure for the state of Alaska. And again, this would be led by the private sector, who would invest potentially their own money in terms of operating this along with the federal infrastructure funds that may become available to Alaska. So next slide, please. The outcome of this would be a significant potential reduction in gas supply costs into Fairbanks, and the ranges that we're talking about from 75% infrastructure funding to 100% would mean that we'd be delivering gas at either a $15 per million BTU or down to a $5 per million BTU level. This would be a reduction from the current rates of about $20 to $22 per million BTU. This is a first phase, would again meet the needs of providing cleaner burning energy to interior Alaska. And it would also then help in terms of the military bases who are looking to convert some of their power plant generation from existing coal fire to potentially new dual fuel cycle turbines. As they look to meet their Department of Defense projected goals of lower carbon emissions from military. And it could also help with additional military or mineral developments by having a lower cost of energy source should there be developments out there. Quickly, Mr. Chairman, on the next slide, I really wanted to just give an indication that there is some progressive think tanks thoughts out there that recognize that natural gas will be invaluable as we make this conversion forward to more carbon neutrality. And this is just some quotes that I found that identify that there are some folks out there that feel that gas will play an indispensable role in renewable energy expansion by providing instantly dispatchable source of electricity. And we will need to retain natural gas generation as a backstop when wind and solar aren't available to be able to meet the energy needs of America. So near the closing, Mr. Chairman, phase one, the opportunity is to work with the private sector to utilize infrastructure funds that may come out of Washington, D.C., to be able to de-risk the Alaska LNG project by having this initial work completed, and ultimately to be able to provide for gas for Alaskans, which is one of our charges, when the full project is developed at a rate of about $5 per million BTU in interior and south central Alaska. Next slide, please. So as we work, move forward, we are working in DC, working with our congressional delegation, as well as the new administration and members of Congress in terms of the leadership, to identify that Alaska has an infrastructure project. It doesn't meet the existing formula funds that one would expect from federal highways or transportation or ports and harbors or water and sewer, but we are not alone in identifying that there are projects out there that don't fit that bill but could still provide for economic opportunities across the nation. Alaska would benefit from the pipeline, but we would be relying on materials coming from factories in the lower 48 for pipe production as well as heavy equipment operation. And then lastly, Mr. Chairman, just in identifying where we are with our budget, we have an operating budget proposal in with the governor's budget, approximately $3.1 billion authorization, and this would be legislature authorizing the expenditure of the Alaska LNG Fund to be able to move the project forward. This represents about a 10% reduction over fiscal year 21 expenditures. In addition, we have statutory program receipt requests as well as federal receipt requests in should we be successful in achieving federal infrastructure funds coming our way. So that, Mr. Chairman, is a very quick overview of our work efforts over the last year. I thank you for the patience of the committee, and I'll be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you, very much, Mr. Clark. Do we have questions from members of the committee?
Sure.
Senator Von Imhoff.
So thank you very much for this presentation, and I think it would be wonderful if the federal government would provide some funds for this phase one, you know, up to $5.8 billion for phase one. But considering since recently the Biden administration just canceled the Keystone pipeline, what gives you confidence that the federal government will provide funds for this particular pipeline?
Through the chair, Senator Von Imhoff. Excellent question. Again, you saw the reaction of the industry as well as the labor unions to that decision by the Biden administration. We've been in discussion with membership within the labor groups to support this project. It is an uphill battle, but again, we see that if we don't ask for the funding, if we aren't willing to march up that hill, then the funds wouldn't become available to us. So we presented this as an option and an opportunity for Alaska to be able to put Alaskans back to work in the very near term.
Thank you. Senator Machicki has a question.
Well, just to dovetail on Senator Von Imhoff's question, my time in the industry, we often refer to LNG as a bridge fuel from heavy oil to green energy, right? And that's was generally accepted in the past. But what I have to tell you is the administration is populated with folks that have intervened in the permitting of every natural gas and LNG project I've been involved in the last 20 years. So I don't know how they bifurcate that, the politics of that to support a natural gas or LNG project for now. I think that is a very real threat, and it's one that concerns me significantly. I don't know if you have a comment about that. I mean, I heard your answer, but I think it's a very real threat when you think about a potential infrastructure project coming forward in the next couple of years or a couple of months that may help with the financing of this project.
Through the chair, Mr. President, you make an excellent point. And again, we had and fought some of those same battles as we went through the environmental authorizations for this project. I can only say that we are having those conversations right now with the administration folks, as well as with the members of Congress, who, you know, based on the makeup of the House and the Senate, there are some potential votes out there that wouldn't be supporting of this project. But we're trying to identify this as an opportunity to build a critical piece of infrastructure for the state of Alaska. Again, it doesn't fit within the green energy role, but as we talk about the opportunities to be able to reduce the impacts of air quality to the citizens of Fairbanks and the surrounding communities, when we talk about the opportunity to be able to provide a cleaner burning source of energy to the river villages, to the native communities, and getting them off the reliance of diesel going forward. Those are points that are resonating with those folks. And then when we ultimately talk about the next phase of the project and then the opportunity to utilize our methane molecules and the potential for blue hydrogen production, that's an opportunity that they are, again, raises their eyebrows because it's not something they've ever considered. And we, again, as I said, with the Cook Inlet Basin opportunity out there, then blue hydrogen production could be in Alaska's future.
Follow-up, Senator Machicki.
Yeah, so I hear what you're saying, and I understand and support the value of what can be distributed for the interior of Alaska. But we're talking about a 42-inch main line, and we're talking about even with immense growth in consumption, maybe 30, 40 million cubic feet a day. Don't smile too hard, but 42-inch mainline, a minor amount of the capacity of such a infrastructure, right? So yes. If you're talking about this being built out, are you talking about a parallel path for private investment in the other half and the export terminal that may fall into place to dovetail relatively immediately? I mean, we don't make money on that volume. We make money on full capacity, right? So is that something that could happen at the same time? Are you looking for some level of support where it would allow you to market the second half, again, significantly risk reduced because of the first installation, right? Is that what you're envisioning, that instead of the way this is kind of written up as though there are two separate stages, and it's hard to look at the economics of the first stage if the second stage is not a reality?
Through the chair, Mr. President, you're absolutely correct. This is not an economic project in and of itself. This is the initial phase of the Alaska LNG project that we would envision proceeding forward in parallel. So instead of the execution plan that we'd originally created for Alaska LNG, where we would start on the modules for the gas treatment plant, the liquefaction, and then we would later do the pipeline, this brings the pipeline segment to the forefront to initiate the work while we are continuing and advancing forward for the full-scale Alaska LNG project. If we are successful in capturing that federal stimulus funds, then that reduces the cost of this project, that we makes this project even more economically viable in the Asian markets, because we can then have a lower cost of supply to those Asian markets. And the private sector investment would be seeing an overall reduction in the overall cost of this project, which they are keenly monitoring and would be supportive of.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Kawasaki.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The thing to mention is it's not just a residential need. I was just looking between Greeley, which has the National Missile Defense Shield, the F-35, the three squadrons of brand new F-35s at Eielson, the Stryker Brigade expansion that's happening at Fort Wainwright, Clear Air Force Base also. There's five coal plants within the area, and that's not including Healy 1 and Healy 2. And I know that the military is strong on finding fuels that'll bridge, and they aren't going to fly on solar. or anything like that, and so this is a necessity for our military, and a strong military for the state. I did have a question, though. My question was, it doesn't necessarily hit Fairbanks directly, Frank. It's about 70 miles west of Fairbanks. There's a lateral line that is supposed to get into Fairbanks, and then I was wondering, so is the lateral line, the gas treatment plant associated storage, is that part of the $5.9 billion?
Through the chair, Senator Kawasaki, again, thank you for those comments around the military. And just one quick aside, Fort Wainwright is currently conducting an environmental impact statement on the conversion of their coal-fired power plant to a new central heating and power plant facility. And that's where gas supply into that would be an opportunity. So that's one of the goals of the military moving forward. The main line terminates down near Chattanooga River, so we're about 30 miles to the west down Murphy Dome Road. And then that lateral has been designed. It was designed under the ASAP project. It would be a 12-inch line that would be able to meet the needs within Fairbanks. And that cost effort, again, is going to depend on that represents about, I don't have it off the top of my head, but that is where private sector has an opportunity to be able to develop that transmission line and to be able to provide that into the Fairbanks community. That is not considered under the Alaska LNG authorizations, so we did not include that in our original request. But again, the overall scope of this project, I think we'll be looking at an opportunity to be able to deliver that gas to Fairbanks at the lowest cost.
That's good enough. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other questions? So I guess I have a question. Back on slide 12, the competitiveness, you have a graph here. And I know it's from 2015, and you mentioned that you found a lot of cost savings. You brought up in your presentation. I think it's great, the jobs. I think it's great bringing energy and all the other positives that might come. But I worry that about the competitiveness and kind of what goes on in my mind is the risk to the state. You know, how can we be certain? It sounds like you brought it down below 8, where it's a little more in line. I was wondering, A, could you get sort of an updated competitive analysis? And B, how can we be assured that we're not going to be subsidizing this gas in the future? Because that looks still pretty in line with some of the most costly gas suppliers. Could you just speak to that a little bit?
Mr. Chairman, yes. So this chart on slide number 12, the far left-hand bar represents the cost as identified in that 2015 timeframe. The cost that for the remaining bars on this chart are up to are $2020. So those are that reflects current cost of supply as we know it from public sources across the board. This Alaska LNG 2021 optimized price is again based on that cost reduction from 44.3 2015 dollars down to 38.7 in 2020 dollars, and as well as this that includes the optimization. So that was the economic stage gate that we went through with the board in representing that we had potential project to be able to that could be competitive in the middle of the pack. But it will take, again, additional work, additional opportunities and optimizations to be able to move this cost farther to the right to be in competitive with those lower cost projects. And those were those things that we would need to talk about, such as the fiscal certainty, the payment in lieu of taxes, the potential federal loan guarantees that are currently out there, as well as additional optimizations to the operations and construction.
Thank you, Mr. Clark. Any other questions? Oh, I'm sorry. Forgive me, Mr. Richards.
Mr. Chairman, one final comment is you asked about the risks of the state, and that's where the discussion for the state of Alaska is how much ownership should we retain for this project. And if this project goes to 100% private ownership, then it's really just the tax revenues that would be at risk to the state if they didn't go forward. Or if the state wants to retain a percentage of ownership, what is that optimal percentage that the state should retain, and what is the risk associated with it?
Thank you, Mr. Richards. Additional questions? All right, well, we really appreciate you being here today. Thanks for all the work you're doing. Next, we will hear from Lorelei Simon, VP of External Affairs at Uzbekistan Coal, some remarks about what their industry is doing and its value to Interior Alaska. Ms. Simon, if you could please put yourself on the record and begin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And for the record, my name is Lorelei Simon. I'm the Vice President of External Affairs for Uzbekistan Coal Mine. I know that all of you are familiar with Uzbekistan, but I do wish I had more time today to give a more thorough overview of our company and our industry. So for Alaskans who are listening, I encourage you to go to our website at uzbekistan.com for more information. Uzbekistan provides coal to 6 coal-fired power plants in Interior Alaska. Without these coal plants, energy costs in the interior would be approximately $140 million more annually. And while the geographic region is large, the population is only about 100,000 people. That's a lot of money for ratepayers who are already paying among the highest rates in the nation. Mr. Chairman, let me get right to my comments on what we've heard today. While I appreciate that AGDC has softened their talking points, I do welcome the opportunity to set the record straight on several items. Slide 9 of Mr. Richards' presentation states, gas will meet the needs of local markets, reducing the use of highly polluting fuels in interior Alaska. This often repeated narrative that coal will be replaced by natural gas or renewables is seldom questioned. But Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I ask you, how realistic is that for interior Alaska? Fairbanks and the surrounding communities rely on coal for roughly 30% of their energy needs, and there is no readily available alternative. As we've heard today, the AK LNG project is not viable without significant government subsidy. That was pointed out on slide 20. Let me discuss air quality in the interior. Numerous air quality monitoring studies have disproved the claim that the particulate matter problem in Fairbanks is from power plants. There is widespread agreement among environmental regulators that the best way to improve air quality in Fairbanks is for homeowners relying on wood for heat to burn dry firewood instead of wet firewood. A wood kiln providing dry firewood is now operating in the community. On slide 25, Mr. Richards implies that the military will benefit from the AK LNG project. Eielson Air Force Base recently rebuilt their coal-fired boilers, and Fort Wainwright is undertaking an EIS process. Coal has provided energy security to Alaska's military bases for decades. Switching to an alternative fuel would burden the military with massive cost increases, the same price hikes that UAF successfully foresaw and avoided by sticking with coal. Additionally, Governor Dunleavy submitted testimony stating that the draft EIS is inadequate, and he questioned fuel switching at Fort Wainwright because of the negative impacts on ratepayers in the region, as well as to Doyon and their shareholders, and to the private sector jobs provided by Yusubeli. Slide 20 and 21 infer that the AK LNG project will help meet President Biden's low carbon initiatives. As discussed by committee members today, Mr. Chairman, you know that President Biden does not consider the development of natural gas resources and the building of gas pipelines as a way to achieve his zero carbon initiatives. President Biden has issued numerous executive orders to stop further development of natural gas resources, including pipelines. Senator Von Imhoff mentioned the halting of the Keystone XL pipeline. He's also issued a moratorium on all federal government activities relating to Coastal Plain oil and gas leasing programs in EMWAR. In closing, Mr. Chairman, what some gas developers consistently do is discount the role and value of coal that coal plays in interior Alaska. What Alaska, the nation, and the world need to do is focus on innovation, on technological innovation to help reduce emissions and also consider the true cost and benefits to public health, the environment, and the economy. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll close, and I would like to invite you and the rest of the committee to join me for the Resource Development Council meeting on April 1st at 7:30 in the morning, where I will give a presentation titled Hidden in Plain Sight, Alaska's Energy Solution. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Ms. Simon. We have a question from,
comment.
A comment from Senator Bishop.
I'd just like to comment, Mr. Chairman. Lorelei, thanks for that presentation. It hasn't been too many years ago right here in this resource committee that the National Park Service had an air quality report that was issued for all national parks in the United States. The cleanest air of any national park was Denali National Park, about 30 miles from a coal-fired power plant. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Bishop. Any questions or? All right. Thank you again, Ms. Simon. We appreciate, and to all of our folks here presenting today, we really appreciate you. It's very interesting. Love the debate. Great takeaways for us. We appreciate you very much. Thanks for being here. We're going to wrap this up. Thank you to committee members for your attention today. And our next meeting will be on Wednesday, March 24th, where we'll be hearing about energy basics from Curtis Thayer of Alaska Energy Authority, as well as House Joint Resolution 12 endorsing ANWR leasing related issues. This meeting is now 4:48. We're adjourned. Good.